This is David Hufford, March 29, 1996. Soul, its meaning in Jungian psychology.
Before I start tonight, I'd just like to say a few words about why I decided to pursue this topic. Last fall, there was a general request put out for people to give topics that they might be interested in speaking to the Jung Society on the issue of soul. And when I got that request, I started thinking, well, it seems like every other book I see these days on Jungian psychology is something about soul, or the says something about soul in the title, but I realized that I didn't really feel like I knew much about it. Just when I started thinking about it, I was wondering, well, what is soul? And what is soul specifically in the context of Jungian psychology? And I realized, the more I thought about it, that I really didn't know. So after at first thinking, well, I have nothing that I can talk about because I don't know anything about the subject, I realized that I hadn't ever really seen anything written or published about specifically what is the meaning and function of the term or the notion of soul in Jungian psychology. So I thought, well, that sounds like a pretty good topic for a lecture. So I proposed that, and I don't know, 7 or 8 months later, here we are. So what I'm going to do tonight is share with you what I've learned after doing a lot of reading in the collected works and Jung's other writings, and sort of putting it all together to see if I can make sense of what Jung has said about soul. I'd also like to say as a beginning that partly because of the nature of this topic, there's going to be a tendency for me to quote from Jung, because I want to be able to talk to you specifically about what Jung said about soul. And there are a few quotes in particular that I really want to share with you because I think they're very interesting. At the same time, I realize that it can get pretty dry hearing somebody doing nothing but quoting, so I'm going to try and keep myself in check with that, but please bear with me as we go along, because I want to try and give you a flavor of Jung's writings and Jung's thoughts on this. So, by way of introduction, I'd like to say that tonight we will explore a mystery. Not only the mystery of soul as a personification of the unconscious, but also the mystery surrounding how the term soul is used and presented in Jung's writings. The first place to look when you're interested in the meaning of a particular term in Jung's writings is Volume 6 of the Collected Works, Psychological Types. That's because in the second half of this volume, Jung has compiled a list of definitions. When I looked up soul in the definitions, the first thing I noticed is, oddly enough, that it hardly refers to soul at all in the course of 7 pages. Instead, Jung seems to spend most of his time talking about the anima, the persona, and their relationship to each other. In fact, I have to admit that I got curious and I counted the words. Soul, in these 7 pages, soul is used 7 times, and anima is used 17 times. Looking closer at this section, I found a footnote, one of 2 related footnotes in the collected works that begins to shed some light on this strange fact. The footnote is from the editors of the English translation, explaining that in the original German text of this volume, Jung, in fact, uses the word anima only 2 times. Everywhere else, he actually used the word Seele, soul in German. But the editors chose to translate Seele instead as anima, or animus, when it seemed Jung was referring specifically either to the feminine component in a man or the masculine component in a woman. They go on to admit that the distinction is not always clear in the text, and that, quote, the reader may prefer to translate anima animus back into soul if it helps to clarify Jung's meaning. So this is the first mystery. It seems that at least in these definitions, and who knows where else in the English edition of the collected works, when we see the word anima or animus, Jung may have actually been using the German word for soul. It has been an interesting exercise to reread familiar passages of Jung regarding the anima and substitute the word soul. It often opens up Jung's meaning in a new way for me. For as we shall see, anima and animus are in fact special cases of soul. But there is a further layer of mystery regarding the meaning and use of the word soul in the collected works. In another footnote, this time in volume 12, the editors discuss the difficulty of translating the German word Seele into English in general. They complain that translating Seele into English creates almost insurmountable problems because its meaning combines the two words psyche and soul in a way that they say is not familiar to, quote, the English reader, unquote. And I think the operative phrase here is the, quote, English reader, perhaps especially the English reader of the 1950s, seeing as how the editors primarily of the English edition were English rather than American. In fact, as we shall see, Jung's use of soul is more familiar to our contemporary American ears. The editors go on to say that when they come across the word psyche, when we as readers come across the word psyche in the English edition, Jung may actually have written either the word psyche or Seele, soul. The editors chose to use the word psyche when they assumed that Jung was referring to the totality of all psychic processes, in other words, as a comprehensive term. They used the word soul in those instances when they assumed Jung's meaning was more restrictive, referring only to specific aspects of the unconscious. And they quote their definition of this restrictive notion of soul as a psychic phenomenological fact of a highly numinous character. Now, I don't know how many of you know what phenomenological means. It took me only 2 years to figure it out. Basically, what that means is that it's a psychic fact in the way that Jung meant it, which is that it's something that we experience. It's something that we experience without reference to theoretical ideas or structuring the way we experience something, but it's just something we experience just as it is. And so it's a psychic fact that all of us experience in our dreams and in other ways images and personifications of something that has, number one, a numinous, a magical character, and that it has a personification. It has a, it's like a an individual. Well, before we plunge into Jung's writings about soul, I just want to give a couple background things. First of all, there are a couple places in the collected works where Jung talks about the etymology of the word. And I just want to share a little bit of that with you as some background. He asks, what is the origin of the word Seele? Now, this is the etymology primarily of the German word for soul. He says, like the English word soul, it comes originally, if you take it back to its root in Greek, it comes from the Greek word aiolos, which means quick-moving, twinkling, iridescent. He also says that the Greek word for psyche means butterfly. And he sees an implied connection there in terms of the sense of the two meanings. Now, he also says that taking another root from another etymological root on the Slavic side to the word sila, S-I-L-A, that word means strength. And he concludes, these connections throw light on the original meaning of the word soul. It is moving force, life force. So that's the etymological sense that Jung had of the word soul, both in German and in English. Now, just to give you a sense of from Jung's writing of the phenomenology, if you will, the qualities of the word soul. Let me just give you a few qualities here. Soul is mysterious. It always has an earthly as well as a ghostly quality. So he says it never loses its intermediate position. It has autonomy, independent existence, objective reality. And as something independent, it is often experienced as potentially capricious and dangerous. Soul is something uncannily alive and active, mysterious and frightening, even as it is at the same time the source of life. Everything that the soul touches becomes numinous, unconditional, dangerous, taboo, magical. Because the soul wants life, he says, it wants both good and bad. The soul is spontaneous, the joy of life and the life urge. I think most of you have a sheet of quotes that I had available, and I just want to mention them because I'll be referring to those periodically throughout the evening, and I always feel like it's helpful to have something in front of me, and one in particular I want to start with as a basic definition, as I have. Gone through the collected works. What I basically did at one point early on in this exploration is that I went through all the collected works and all the copies, all the other material that I had of Jung's writings, and I just looked up in all the indexes and I looked at every single place where Jung used the word soul, and I started collecting quotes of where he used it in a way that helped understand or make sense of its meaning, rather than just using it in passing, assuming that the reader knew what he meant. And there are several definitions that I think are going to be helpful about that, but the one that I found that is most succinct and most clear is the one which is: we define the soul on the one hand as the relation to the unconscious, and on the other as a personification of unconscious contents. Now that's the basic core definition that I'm going to be working from throughout this evening, and I'm going to be using this definition as a way of opening up and unpacking what Jung means by this. I also want to give you one more distinction that he makes, and it's a distinction that's similar to the distinction that I mentioned that the editors made between psyche and soul. He says at one point, "I have been compelled to make a conceptual distinction between soul and psyche. By psyche, I understand the totality of all psychic processes, conscious as well as unconscious." I think that's an important distinction. Conscious as well as unconscious. "By soul, on the other hand, I understand a clearly demarcated functional complex that can best be described as a personality. Now, the two things in there are it's a clearly demarcated functional complex, which I'll be, in other ways, be talking about more, and also the fact that it's a personality. So let me give some explanation and give some more sense of what Jung means when he says that the soul is a personification. Okay, I want to start there, and then after we get a sense of that, then I'll move toward the more abstract notion of it being a function or a relation. As a personification, that means that the soul, whenever we experience the soul, we experience in some way or another an autonomous personality. And we often experience it as a personality with a face, either out in the world or inside us. But it's as if we were encountering another person, someone different than us. And the reason, aside from the fact that the editors chose to do it this way, I think the reason why they did choose to use the word animus and anima primarily so many times in the definition on soul is because when you read through Jung, you discover that so often he refers to anima as a personification of soul. And often he talks about it as if that was the only personification. That was the personification of soul. It's the anima or the animus. Now we'll find out that really isn't true, that he just has that way of talking at times. But in other places he makes a distinction clear. But as a way of beginning to talk about the personification of soul, it's good to talk about the anima and the animus. Now unfortunately, Jung often talked about the anima and didn't talk about the animus or sort of assumed that you knew that he was only talking about masculine psychology and sort of assume the complement would be true about feminine psychology. So in some of these quotes tonight, I'm going to be adding in, I'm going to be trying to remember to talk about them both together because it is important to talk about them as a pair. Now, he says at some point that he has defined the anima as a personification of the unconscious. And you see, at this point, he's talking about the anima the same way he talks about the soul. It's a personification of the unconscious. And he says that there is nothing autonomous in the psyche that is impersonal or neutral. Impersonality is a category pertaining only to consciousness, not to unconsciousness. All autonomous psychic factors have the character of personality. He says, anima and animus likewise have a personality character, and this cannot be better expressed than by the word soul. See, right there, and in other places, he makes it very clear that when he's talking about anima and animus, he's talking about soul. In talking about the anima as soul, he says, whenever she appears in dreams, visions, or fantasies, she takes on a personified form. She is not an invention of the conscious, but a spontaneous product of the unconscious. Now, I want to make sure you understand that that's also true of the animus. He is not an invention of the conscious. He is a spontaneous product of the unconscious. Anima and animus are an experience of soul in relationship. That's their special quality. That when we experience what we talk about as anima or animus, we're talking about experiencing relationship and all the feelings, negative and positive, that go with that. Jung says that when we, just as we can speak of an inner personality, or that we can speak of an inner personality with as much justification as we can speak of an outer personality. He says the inner personality is a way that one behaves in relation to one's inner psychic processes. It's the inner attitude, the characteristic face that is turned toward the unconscious in all of us. He calls the outer attitude, the outer face, the persona. The inner attitude, the inner face, he calls the anima or the animus. So right there, he makes a very specific contrast opposition between the anima or animus and the persona. He says that as a rule, the anima, the soul, or the animus, by and large, is complementary to the character of the persona, so that the anima usually contains all the common human qualities that the conscious attitude, the persona, lacks. So you see, in that notion, he's talking about the persona and the anima as being not only complementary, but being in tension with each other. They're oppositions, in a way. The anima, the soul, is always the a priori element. It means it's always the element that's there before anything else, always the ground. It's always the a priori element in a person's moods, reactions, impulses, and whatever else is spontaneous in psychic life. It is something that lives of itself, that makes us live. It is a life behind consciousness that cannot be completely integrated with it, but from which, on the contrary, consciousness arises. It's interesting in this quote that he's talking about the life quality, the spontaneous quality of soul and soul image, which is what he calls the anima and the animus, the soul image. But he's also talking about it as the ground from which consciousness arises. And I think we'll find that that's because basically soul is the image of the unconscious. It's the image and the archetypal image that we experience of the unconscious. That's what's so. Sometimes he talks about soul the same way he talks about the unconscious. So what we have so far is that the soul, in the form of the anima and the animus, is experienced as an autonomous, independent personality with characteristic set of feelings and qualities unique to each individual, and yet it's archetypal. These qualities are usually made up of the qualities that the conscious personality does not have. You know, it's interesting. My recollection is that whenever I've heard anyone talk about the anima or the animus, they all, at least in a classical sense, because there are more contemporary notions in Jungian psychology about what those two terms mean. But in a classical sense, they always talk about Jung saying that the anima is always feminine for the man and the animus is always masculine for the woman. That's just a given. And yet, one little thing I discovered in that definition in Volume 6 was he makes a comment in passing. He says, well, that's usually true, except when there is an identification on the part of an individual with their persona. And the soul, the anima, or the animus, is so unconscious that they have absolutely no connection with it at all. If they are so completely identified with their persona, he says, then invariably we see that the anima or the animus is going to be personified in dreams as the same sex as the dreamer. It's a very interesting notion. I've never seen that anywhere else, but there it is in the definitions of soul. So it's something to think about. So the animus animus is a personified experience of soul, specifically as a contrasexual image, usually. Either an inner image in dreams and fantasies, or an outer image as its qualities are projected onto others. And it is often through projection that the soul first makes these unlived qualities in ourselves conscious. That's really the function of projection, is that that's often the first way we get to experience it in consciousness, is by projecting it onto someone else and experiencing it through them. With the archetype of the anima, the soul, we enter the realm of the gods. Everything the soul touches becomes numinous, unconditional, dangerous, taboo, magical. Because the soul wants life, she wants both good and bad, because these qualities do not exist in the realm in which she travels. He says every mother, and I think it's important to add every father, and every beloved is forced to become the carrier and the embodiment of this omnipresent and ageless image, which corresponds to the deepest reality in all of us. She or he is the much-needed compensation for risks, struggles, sacrifices that all end in disappointment. She is the solace for the bitterness of life. And at the same time, she and he is the great illusionist, the seductress, who draws us into life with her Maya, and only not only into life's reasonable and useful aspects, but into its frightening paradoxes and ambivalences, where good and evil, success and ruin, hope and despair counterbalance one another. Because soul is our greatest danger, it demands from us our greatest. And if we have it to give, she or he will receive it. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's a little something strange that's been coming up as I've talked about the way Jung refers to the anima and the animus, or the soul in this particular sense. Because in the one and the same time, he talks about it as an inner attitude, an inner face that we turn toward the unconscious. Okay, so it's like a face that an inner attitude that we have toward the unconscious. But at the same time, he says that it's a personification of the unconscious. It's the face of the unconscious that is turned toward us. So there's a paradox there. It's the soul seems to be both the inner face that we have toward the unconscious and the face that the image that the unconscious turns toward us. And you'll see as we go along that paradox is going to be more fully developed, because that's one of the qualities of soul, is this paradoxical nature of its intermediate relationship between consciousness and the psyche or the unconscious. Now, before we move on, I also want to say that it's important to remember that the anima and the animus are not the only possible soul images. The soul image is actually personifying the unconscious, and there are other ways in which it can be personified. Jung says at one point, "I would like to remark that the anima and the animus are not the only autonomous figures or souls in the unconscious, though in practice they are the most immediate and the most important." And I think he says that because it's often that relational energy and that relational experience that we first encounter and first grabs us and first gets us embroiled in working out what for us becomes a way of trying to take in what were otherwise unconscious qualities in ourselves. Other aspects of soul Some of the ways that he refers to other aspects at times is, among other things, he refers to the animal soul. He talks at one point about the region of the psyche, which is not unjustly said to be inhabited by pans, satyrs, dog-headed baboons, and half-men. This is the region of the psyche where the animal soul resides. And he talks about how you can even think of the psyche as having all the same layers that the man's anthropological development has, going all the way through Pithecanthropus and the hominids and the cold-blooded saurians, deepest down of all to the transcendental mystery and the paradox of the sympathetic and the parasympathetic psychoid processes. This is all part of what he refers to as the animal soul quality. At another point, he says that he notes that the animal, and this would be in dreams mostly, but the animal is a symbolic carrier of the self, meaning the center of the psyche. So the animal soul can be one way in which we encounter the self. In another place, he refers to mana, daimon, God, as synonyms for the unconscious. He says that the great advantages of these concepts lies in making possible a much better objectification of the vis-a-vis, namely a personification of it. Now, I had to scratch my head over that a little. What was he talking about? What does he mean, the objectification of the vis-a-vis? And I realized that this is a description of the soul process, of what the soul does as a function. We'll get to that in a minute. But it's another way of talking about the personification of the unconscious through the soul, objectifying it in our psychic reality. And that daimon, God, those are also ways to experience the soul in a personified form, is what he's saying. So we can read into this a little and assume that all the archetypal experiences in dreams and in other ways that we might have, the images, the personifications that we might have, in one way or another, Jung is saying they're all personifications of soul. The self, God, anima and animus. At one point, he also adds into that group the shadow. These are all experienced as personifications, usually. And personifications are experiences of the soul. Now, let's talk about what he means when he says that the soul is a relation. The soul is a function between consciousness and the unconscious. And it seemed to me that there were three ways that Jung talked about the function of the soul. Clinically or theoretically, he talks about the soul's compensatory nature as a necessary correction to the one-sidedness of the ego, integrating unconscious contents into consciousness and freeing up libido. He says at one point that unconscious compensation is always aimed at the conscious positions, which are most strongly defended, because they are the most questionable. It's an interesting observation. Though the soul's apparent hostile aspect at times merely reflects the surly face with which the ego turns toward it. In reality, the unconscious compensation is not intended as a hostile act, but as a necessary and helpful attempt to restore the balance. You know, when we have dreams in which somebody's chasing us or in which somebody's attacking us, it seems like he's suggesting that those are dream experiences in which, as a soul function, there's a compensation going on where the psyche, the unconscious, through the soul function is trying to get our attention We experience it as a hostile act in the dream, but its intention really is a necessary and helpful attempt to restore some balance that's lacking in our conscious lives. It's always not always easy to grasp that and to experience that when we wake up from a dream like that. He says the soul is a personification of the unconscious. Where lies the treasure? The libido, which is immersed in introversion. So somewhere in the unconscious is a treasure, which is energy, which is life force, which is the experience of life, the juice of life, which needs to be liberated. The symbols of the soul the symbols that the soul creates are always grounded in the unconscious archetype, but their manifest forms are molded by ideas acquired by the conscious mind. The archetypes are the numinous structural elements of the psyche and possess an autonomy and a specific energy which enables them to attract out of the conscious mind those contents which are best suited to themselves. The reason I read this is because it seems to me that this is a very important point about the experience of an archetypal image or the experience of a numinous image. Is that what he's saying is that archetypal energies are grounded in a way that we cannot experience directly. We can only experience it through an image. And the image, in one way or another, comes through our lived experience. Comes through cultural or personal or historical images or feelings or whatever it is. But we have to have... The archetype only gets experienced as an archetypal image, which is what the soul is. It's the image. It's the face of the unconscious as it gets presented to us. So the soul becomes that intermediate possibility of experiencing the archetype through image or through personification. From a personal point of view, a feeling point of view, soul is the life urge, the carrier of life and passion. It is the soul's task to see that life is lived in each one of us. There's this next quote I really like from Jung. It's, being that has soul is living being. Soul is the living thing in man. That which lives of itself and causes life. With her cunning play of illusions, the soul lures into life the inertness of matter that does not want to live. She makes us believe incredible things, that life may be lived. She is full of snares and traps in order that we should fall, should reach the earth, entangle ourselves there, and stay caught, so that life should be lived. Were it not for the leaping, twinkling of the soul, we would rot away in our greatest passion, idleness. To have soul is the whole venture of life, for soul is the life-giving daimon who plays his elfin game above and below human existence. To me, that really speaks about the quality of soul that I think is the essence of what Jung is trying to talk about and trying to express regarding the reason why, the function of the soul as a life force, as a life process. In another place, he says something which is... feels very provocative. He says that an individual's life is the soil in which his soul can and must develop. The idea that our life is something that has to exist for the soul or the unconscious, because the soul is really the messenger of the unconscious. For the unconscious to live, our life is the soil that it must have. And that to me really speaks about the quality of relationship and the quality of necessity of the relationship between the unconscious and our lived life. Yeah. An individual's life, our life, is the soil in which our soul can and must develop. So long as we know that we are the carrier of life and that it is therefore important for us to live, the mystery of our soul lives also. No matter whether we are conscious of it or not. But if we no longer see the meaning of our life in its fulfillment, then we are betrayed and have lost our soul. That's another really important image, I think. The notion of that the meaning of life is in its fulfillment. It's not in what we imagine, it's in what we do with it. It's in what we embody. That's where the meaning is. Okay, the third, just so I remind you where we are, this is the next is the third way in which Jung talks about the functional quality of soul. And this is more from the archetypal point of view, the more abstract in a certain way, but I think gets to the heart of trying to understand what's going on here. Because from the archetypal point of view, the function of soul is to give birth to God, or the self, what Jung calls the determining force of the self, operating from the depths, to incarnate the self-realization of the unconscious in each and every life. I don't know how many of you have read Jung's autobiography. If you haven't, I would recommend it. But whether you have or not, I will give you the very first two sentences in the autobiography, which sums up everything I'm talking about and sums up Jung's life. He says, "My life is a story of the self-realization of the unconscious. Everything in the unconscious seeks outward manifestation. And the personality, too, desires to evolve out of its unconscious conditions and to experience itself as a whole." So there it is. Now that we know something about what he's talking about with soul, you can hear the soul function that he's referring to. When he says that his life is a story of the self-realization of the unconscious, that's the soul function, is to give realization in lived life to the unconscious. He says everything in the unconscious seeks outward manifestation. That's the soul trying to do its job. And he includes in that our conscious personality. We too have evolved emerged out of the unconscious and desire to evolve and experience ourselves as whole. The soul must be regarded as a function of relation between the subject, the conscious ego, and the inaccessible depths of the unconscious. So, as a function, the soul is a, pro, a, a, a a function of relation, of connection between the ego, the conscious ego, and the unconscious. The determining force, God or the self, operating from these depths is reflected by the soul. That is, it creates symbols and images and is itself only an image. By means of these images, the soul conveys the force of the unconscious to the conscious. The soul is both a receiver and a transmitter, an organ for perceiving unconscious contents. What is he saying there? He's saying that something very strange and interesting. He's saying that what the soul is a function of relationship, symbolic, a living symbol. Turn them into a symbol. And it also has the ability to present that symbol to us in a way that we can experience it. So the soul has a very remarkable and important task. It's the soul, according to Jung, that allows the relationship to exist between the unconscious and the conscious. It allows us to experience the unconscious as symbols or as images in some way. That's the basic soul function. Now, he talks about it in terms of its experience as God being born into the soul and thus into consciousness. That the soul is the birthplace for God into consciousness, or the self into consciousness, or the unconscious into consciousness. In another paragraph, a little while along in this same section, he says it in slightly different words. He says, the organ of perception, the soul, apprehends the contents of the unconscious and as a creative function gives birth to its dynamis, the dynamic energy of the unconscious, God or the self. Gives birth to its dynamis in the form of a symbol. Now, those of you who are familiar with the term or happened to come to my lecture a year ago on the transcendent function, you will hear in this that what Jung is talking about when he's talking about the soul and it's as a function, he's talking about the transcendent function. In essence, the soul is the image or the personification of the transcendent function. So what this all means as a lived experience is that the soul gives birth to the meaning in our lives and helps us live out our potential wholeness as fully as possible. He says, the picture I have drawn of the anima, the soul, so far is not complete. Although she may be the chaotic urge to life, something strangely meaningful clings to her, a secret knowledge, a hidden wisdom, which contrasts most curiously with her irrational elfin nature. It is just the most unexpected, the most terrifyingly chaotic things which reveal a deeper meaning. Only when all the props and crutches are broken and no cover from the rear offers even the slightest hope of security does it become possible for us to experience an archetype that up until now has laid hidden behind the meaningful nonsense played out by the soul. This is the archetype of meaning, just as the soul is the archetype of life itself. In volume 9.1, there is a very interesting dream that he tells. It's a dream of a young seminarian student. And I won't go into the whole dream unless you really want me to because it's a long dream, but it's a really fascinating dream about two magicians. There's a white magician all dressed in black, and there's a black magician all dressed in white. And they, in the dream, they are conferring about some mystery that the black magician, all dressed in white, has discovered, having to do with the keys of paradise. Okay? That's just a synopsis, all right? In talking about this dream, Jung says that the two magicians are indeed two aspects of the wise old man. That's another archetypal image. The superior master and teacher, the archetype of the spirit, who symbolizes the pre-existent meaning hidden in the chaos of life. So the archetype of the spirit, the wise old man, is the symbol of pre-existent meaning hidden in the chaos of life. And then he says something very strange. He says he, the magician, or the wise old man, is the father of the soul. And yet the soul, in the same miraculous manner, in some miraculous manner, is also his virgin mother. I'll go over that again so we can try and figure out the family tree here. The wise old man is the father of the soul. So the soul must be his daughter. All right. And yet, the soul, in some miraculous manner, is also his virgin mother. Now, that has a lot of echoes. One echo is the virgin birth of Jesus, okay? If we think of if a Christian thinks of Jesus as being in some way God, and he gets born in someone that he made, then somehow he's being born in someone that he made. Well, so it's so, but and the, you know, in mythology, there are a lot of other places where this strange connection occurs, and it also occurs in alchemy too, this kind of connection. But the important thing I think for tonight is that it's also a description, if we think about it, it's a description of how the soul functions, because the soul is at one and the same time born out of the unconscious. It's an aspect of the unconscious, and it's also what gives birth to the unconscious so that we can experience it. It gives birth to its own father or mother. And just for good measure, it's a virgin birth. Now, before we leave all this, there's one more thing I want to briefly talk about. And that has to do with another aspect of what we've been talking about all night. Because somewhere in the same volume, in 9.1, Jung says something rather provocative to all of us who think we've known something about all this stuff. He says, anyone who does not know the significance of syzygy, and he goes on to say syzygy in mythology and history and religion and primitive experience. If anyone who does not know the significance of the syzygy motif, there's no vowels in there, syzygy motif, anyone who doesn't know about that can hardly claim to say anything about the concept of anima, and by inference, the concept of soul. So he's saying, if you don't know about syzygy in all its ramifications and all of its manifestations, if you don't know it inside and out, you don't have any right talking about anima or soul. Well, what is syzygy? Besides a very interesting word, if I had something up here, I'd write it out for you, just because it's so fun to write. S Y Z-Y-G-Y. It's got three Y's in it. Three Y's. For such a short word, it's got a lot of Y's. Let me give you a couple definitions of syzygy. One definition is that syzygy is an archetypal pattern depicted in mythology as pairs of gods or a mortal and a god when it's closer to the human sphere. Okay? It is not an image of the relations between two people or between people, but of relations per se. In other words, the function of relations. The linking quality that has its own life and its own sphere of operations. Linking quality. That's what we've been talking about soul. That's what soul is. It's a linking quality between conscious and unconscious. So another definition from the Critical Dictionary of Jungian Analysis says that it's a term applied to any pair of opposites when spoken of as a pair, whether in conjunction or opposition. Someone told me recently that in astrology, the term syzygy is used for an astrological conjunction or opposition. They're both syzygies. Now, part of this definition is that bisexuality is not implied. It means it's not about bisexuality or hermaphrodite experience. Rather, it's about the complementary functioning of otherwise opposed elements. In other words, it's about relationship. It's about relationship between two complementary or even two opposed qualities or people or experiences. We have been talking about syzygy all night, even though I haven't said anything about it. We've been talking about a lot of pairs of opposites that have a necessary relationship and connection to each other. Anima animus, unconscious conscious. Wise old man and the soul, or the anima. There are a lot of others, if I could remember them. I think in an imagery way, the most useful, for me anyway, the most useful image of what a syzygy is the yin-yang symbol in Taoist or Chinese philosophy. And I imagine you all know what that looks like, right? I don't have anything to draw with here, but it's a circle, and in the circle there are like two snakes that form a matched pair, one dark and one light. Now, what really makes that image a syzygy is because in the middle of each of them, in the fattest part of each of them, is a little seed of the other. So that there is always a movement toward change and relationship. There's always a tension. It's never static. It's never finished. It's always in relation and always moving. That's the essence of syzygy. And that's the essence of soul and its function and its connection. And the way it keeps things moving between the unconscious and the conscious in all of us. Well, let's take a break. And we'll come back. And what time is it? We'll come back in, I don't know, 15 minutes or so. And I'd love to hear some questions. Okay? Your patience by asking you to indulge me. I'm going to read you one more quote. And then I promise I won't read any more unless you ask. But the quote is on the sheet I gave you. And I thought it was only fair to include this, sort of to give Jung, as it were, the last word about all this. It's the quote down at the bottom if you want to follow along. The mere use of words is futile when you do not know what they stand for. This is particularly true in psychology, where we speak of archetypes such as the anima and the animus, the wise old man, the great mother, and so on. You can know all about the saints, sages, prophets, and other godly men and all the great mothers of the world. But if they are mere images whose numinosity you have never experienced, it will be as if you were talking in a dream, for you will not know what you are talking about. The mere words you use will be empty and valueless. They gain life and meaning only when you try to take into account their numinosity, in other words, their relationship to the living individual. Only then do you begin to understand that their names mean very little, whereas the way they are related to you is all important. Yes?
You spoke of life experience, what we do is being soil for our soul.
Hmm.
And I wanted to speak to the appropriateness of a phenotypic word versus inappropriate word, and that's dichotomy to the soul.
Now, what do you mean by work?
Well, I mean what I do for a living.
I would think that would be so much a question of you or the particular individual. I mean, in one sense, any kind of work is appropriate for somebody. You know, every kind of work in the world probably for somebody is going to be just the work they need to do to individuate, to become really who they are. But the trick is to figure out what your work is. And that's not something you can just sort of point to. You gotta, you know, it probably goes back to that notion that meaning comes out of living life. The meaning is in life's fulfillment. So you figure out what you should be doing in life by trying it, you know, and by taking chances and by responding to what's presented to you, I guess. And you know, sometimes that's the only way you find out that there is something in particular you don't want to do is by trying it. Say, yep, I tried it, and nope, that's not what I want to do. But maybe before you tried it, you thought maybe that was what you wanted to do. So, does that sort of speak to what you were asking? Or?
Yeah, I think more the opposite of, you know, being in a job, for instance, that doesn't, or what kind of consequences of being in a job is inappropriate for an individual, the effect on what you do with the soul.
Ah, well. That can have, you know, depending on the job, I can imagine it can have minor consequences or devastating consequences. Again, it's going to be the individual experience. Some people, you know, oh, well, it's just a job, no big deal, you know. It's a paycheck and I go home and I do what I really want to do. Other people, for whatever reason, you know, if they're in something that just is just destroying their soul, then they have to do something about it. They're being, in a way, they're being challenged to deal with it in some way or another. Yes?
I think there can be a soul of an organization.
Sure. In fact, I'm sure people have written books with that title.
I guess I'm just interested in how that functions in relation to what, you know, what you've been talking about with regards to individuals.
Well, that gets more into something that I can speak about a little bit, but it's a whole another area of soul in a way. It's in one of the things that's one of the things that Jung talked about in is the something called the anima mundi, which is roughly translated, it's the soul of the world. It's a world soul. It's a sense of soul being more a collective field or a collective experience. And so in that sense, what is the animating, you know, if we can put, sort of put it into the terms we've been using, what is the animating quality, the animating energy of an organization, of a community, of a group, of a nation, of a globe? But, you know, if you can begin to wonder about that, you can imagine you can get a sense of it. I know that looking back on it, this isn't quite the same thing, but I think it's related. When I have thought about all the organizations, all the jobs that I've worked at, where there's been an ongoing kind of culture of that particular organization or that particular business or whatever. Every organization seems to have its own culture, and no matter who comes into it and says, "Okay, we're going to do things differently," there's a real tendency for it to just sort of stay its own culture, and that maybe that's something about its soul quality, what's animating it in that way. But that would be the way I would, as a beginning, that would be the way I would think about an organization and what's the soul of an organization, to think about it in terms of what's animating it. But that also means you have to think about what is being unlived. What's the unconscious of that organization? What's unlived? And is trying to get lived out. And maybe it's trying to get lived out by acting out, by breaking into consciousness, you know, in ways the same way. I don't know. Do you know any organizations that are depressed or there's something there that's trying to get acknowledged that isn't being acknowledged. Yes.
Yeah, you know, when you describe this soul to the self, it sounds a lot to me like the kind of relationship of like how the Shiva Shakti clarity.
A little bit. A little bit.
So I was just wanting to hear a little bit more about the difference there. I know you said, you know, you said the soul is the birthplace for the self to come to consciousness.
Well, In Jungian psychology, first of all, I need to make sure that I have either not spoken or you have misheard, because in Jungian psychology, the self with a capital S is a very specific concept. Okay, it's very different than the self with a little S, right?
So I'm just thinking of self with a big S.
Yes.
Well,
the self with a big S would be the equivalent of the God image, okay? And so that is the animating principle, if you will, of the psyche as a whole. And so that is what is trying to get, you can think of it as that is the animating principle that's trying to get born through the function of the soul. That's right. The soul as a function, as a functional process through which the self, God, whatever you want to call it, in each of us, tries to get born into this individual and collective life. So does that help with your question? I'm not sure. Okay, well, you mentioned spirit. Now, I think that what we talked about with the wise old man, as Jung seemed to be saying, there is an archetype, is an image of the archetype of the spirit. And that's, you know, that image of the syzygy, it's one of the pairs is spirit, is spirit and soul. One of the pairings in a syzygy is spirit and soul. Spirit as the wise old man, as meaning, and soul as life. And there's that image of spirit being the father of soul, and soul being the virgin mother of spirit. There's that There's that paradoxical relationship and movement. So that's also the relationship between soul and God, soul and self. Okay, it's a paradoxical relationship. Part of the paradox is that soul is at one and the same time a function that really doesn't exist other than just being an abstract function. The only way, and at the same time, it's the image, it's the only way that we experience the unconscious in that sense. It's every time we experience an image that we experience as an unconscious or a numinous image, we are in effect experiencing the soul. But we're experiencing the soul only as a carrier for the self or the unconscious. It's the personification, it's the face, it's the of the unconscious, of the self, of God. Okay, I'll come to you, but I want to make sure that...
I think the closest metaphor is the thing to be, like in Hinduism, because they really break down and make those differentiations.
And they do that wonderfully, wonderfully subtly in ways that I probably would never be able to understand. Yeah. Yes?
Well, I have the same question she had.
Okay. Yes, yes, that's one way to think about it. Soul is a messenger, an agent. It's like, I was going to use the metaphor, but I couldn't stand to use it. Can you think of soul as a TV set? No.
Transmitter.
It's, yeah, because in one of the places Jung says it's the soul is both a receiver and a transmitter. So it's receiving the unconscious, and it's transmitting it to us in the form of images or in the form of emotion. I mean, images are not only visual. Images are also emotional and intellectual and intuitive. But it's transmitting it to us. That's the way we get it. We only can get it through the intercession, as it were, of the soul. Soul is a function in that way. Yes. Why does the word Nietzsche come up? Will is what I don't know. I'd have to. I haven't spent as much time on will as I have on soul recently. So off the top of my head, I'd say that will has a lot to do with conscious intent and what we control. And okay, I will change the way I relate to the unconscious, or I will stop having fantasies about that woman at the office. Well, it doesn't work that way. I mean, once the unconscious gets involved, once the soul gets involved, in other words, it's a defeat of the will. You know, I think that's one of the things that you have to struggle with, is that you've experienced that defeat, that you can't control your feelings, you can't control what wants to be born. You can't just say, go away, get out of here.
Like love,
yeah. You've got to somehow deal with it. Doesn't mean you got to just go out and do whatever feeling you have. But it means there's something that wants to be born, and if you don't find a way to relate to it, it's going to keep coming in sideways, and it doesn't matter how much will you have. Except for those rare individuals that I feel sorry for that have such strong wills that they can essentially keep out all the possibility of life that's unlived. And they live their whole lives being very... You know, and they die, and they've never given themselves a chance.
Well, since they knew there are different aspects of the will.
Okay.
There's that external will, and then maybe transpersonal will.
Well, I don't know much about that, but it sounds a lot like the self. So, did you have a question? Yeah. I would imagine, but it's a question of whether they ever come to a sense that they have to deal with something other than to be more controlled. Yeah, I mean, if you ask them, if you ask people that knew them, they'd say, "Oh yeah, I can tell you how that, you know, I can tell you how it works." Especially people that hate them, you know, they can really tell you. Yes.
I thought that will might have something to do with the syzygy between spirit and soul.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when they're in.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, if they're in accordance, then that's not really a problem for luck.
Right.
But I mean, if there was a conflict or if you had this choice, you could either listen to the wise old man or you could go with the soul.
Well, yeah. And I don't know, I think it's always both. Well, you got to listen to both of them somehow. But I think you're right. I think any time you feel or sense or are aware of that tension between what seem like two opposing somethings, then you're talking about a syzygy, you're talking about the transcendent function, you're talking about individuation, you're talking about the possibility that some third symbol is going to get created if you can hold that long enough, and something new is going to be born. So yes, you're right. That's hadn't thought about that between will and soul. There is no free lunch. I mean, there is no free will. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, don't believe it. It will always cost. It you never can get it for free. Yes?
In the old mountain village in Switzerland, there is an interesting example of an ancient concept of the soul.
Uh-huh.
There is a house, maybe more than one house, with a hole in the wall, in the outer wall, and it is only for the purpose of the soul being able to fly out when somebody dies in the house. So I was wondering what you think or what Jung thinks about life after death, the soul after death.
Well, I don't know for sure. What I do know is that Jung, in several places, was very clear to make a distinction between his notion of soul and the traditional Christian notion of soul. The traditional Christian notion of soul includes a sense of transcendence, a sense of life after death as part of the quality of soul. And Jung was very clear several times to say that's not what he means when he means soul. He means something very much, to use his terminology, very much more primitive than that. It's the sort of soul that has to do with life animation, it doesn't necessarily imply transcendence. So I don't know what Jung thought about life after death, although I haven't read it in years, and so I don't remember exactly what he said, but it seems to me that at the end of Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, his autobiography, I think he has a chapter on life after death. I think that's true. I'd have to go look, but I bet you'd find some thoughts. They're late thoughts or something like that. And, you know, your lovely accent reminded me that somebody during the break told me that I was pronouncing the word S-E-E-L-E incorrectly. Could you pronounce it for me?
Zela.
Zela. Zela. Okay, so I was pronouncing it Sela, and it's wrong. I was wrong. It's Zela. Okay. Yes. Is Geist a ghost?
Well,
or something else? Spirit. Spirit. Okay, spirit. Zeitgeist, yes.
Also, it contains some of what we were. I mean, it's some of the qualities of Geist, as I recall, also have some of the qualities that we use
transcendent soul.
Hmm. Okay. Good. Could you help us with that? Geist and Seele? Is there... Do you...
I would say Geist is spirit.
Spirit. Okay. Yes?
I would guess that the Hebrew kind of understanding of the soul is probably closer to the things that you talked about than maybe the later Greek disembodied soul.
Yeah, same...
At creation, God breathes into nostrils the breath of life, and human beings became living souls.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a more holistic sense for the Hebrew sense of soul.
Yes.
I think it's nephesh.
You remind me that in one place in where Jung is talking about etymology, that he says that the Greek words anima and animus both, or the Latin words, excuse me, anima and animus both stem from a Greek word that means wind. So all that very early notion of soul being something, soul having something to do with breath. That we can, you know, breathe out or breathe in the soul of life, you know. We even still have that, don't we? I mean, when somebody gives artificial respiration, they call it the breath of life.
Also, centered positive.
Yes.
So, when you see the five psyches, the totality of all psychic processes, and soul is just that restricted aspect of the psyche. What is not the soul?
Consciousness. Because remember, the psyche is both the unconscious and the conscious. When Jung says it's the totality, it means it's everything that we are, both conscious and unconscious.
So consciousness is not the soul?
No, although I think we experience the soul in consciousness a lot. But, I was saying this. I was saying to somebody at the break, we not only experience soul in terms of that inner face that we turn to our own unconscious experience, our own inner experience, but we also experience it in relationship, in projected. And it's, I don't know about you, but it seems to me that most of the time it's about, somewhere between 40 and 60% of relationships are projections, are unconscious. You know, so all that's, I mean, when the way Jung talks about it, it seems that's all soul experience. Well, all the projected stuff, all the unconscious stuff that we experience in our relationships with other people, we're really experiencing soul. Then we can experience it in here instead of out there. We can actually begin to experience that person more as themselves instead of some soul aspect of ourselves.
So you say soul is becoming conscious?
Yes, yes. Soul first becomes conscious in one sense by getting into all the people we know. And we live out our, you know, we get to interact with our soul and experience it in consciousness that way. And then eventually starting to become more aware of what the difference is between who they really are, who these people we know really are, and who, or what our soul experience, what our unconscious experience is. Yes, I mean that. Yes. Yes. Yes, yes. Sort of like the difference between a conscious fool and an unconscious fool, right? I think if we knew enough, we'd all be striving to be conscious fools, but most of us instead are unconscious fools.
Well, this might be kind of a naive question, but can a soul evolve or change over lifetime? Or what's going on?
Well, let's think about it in the way that Jung talked about it, because soul is an image, okay? It's an image which is an experience of an unconscious content, an unconscious personification, an unconscious archetype. So what's important is to distinguish between the archetype, the unconscious content, and the image. The image will evolve. For instance, you could have a series of dreams in which a particular figure went from being someone who was attacking you and trying to kill you to being someone that was, he was around, but he wasn't giving you such a hard time, to eventually he might become your best friend in the dream, or he might become someone that saves your life. Okay? That image has transformed. Okay, your experience of that figure has transformed radically. Now, Jung would say that the archetype that figure represents, the unconscious content that figure represents, has not changed as an archetypal structure. But what's changed is your experience of it, which is the image, which is the soul image of that. So remember that quote I mentioned about how in compensation, when the soul it does this compensation in dreams and stuff, often we might experience it as something attacking or destructive, but it really is the unconscious's way of trying to get us to deal with something that we're not conscious of, trying to get us to deal with a restricted or one-sided attitude. And when we do, that our image of it changes. Okay. It reminds me, I've been looking for this story for years and I can't find it. I swear that years ago I read a story in Hindu mythology that was, and I'll give you the synopsis of the story. It was a group of wise men, and they decided they were all going to go out and they were going to find the gods. And so they started on this trek, and of course they had to bring along, being good upper class wise men, they had to bring along their sherpa, the servant who carried all the stuff and cooked the meals and stuff. So one night they were out in the middle of the wilderness, didn't know where they were. It was dark, wasn't anything around, and they were sitting around the fire, and all of a sudden they were surrounded by these huge menacing demons, and all the wise men shrieked in terror, and the only one that didn't react negatively was the servant. He bowed very, very piously to all these terrible demons. When he did, they all transformed, and there were the gods that all these wise men had been seeking all this time. So that seems to me to be a story about, I don't know, maybe I made it up, maybe I dreamed it, I don't know, but that seems to be a story about how it can transform. The gods are always the same, but our experience of them, our image of them, our way of feeling and experiencing our relationship to them changes. Who does?
Joseph Campbell.
Campbell, oh yeah.
In fact, his definition of of demons are that aspect of divinity that we haven't recognized.
Yes, yes.
And as soon as we recognize it, we're gone.
Yes, yes. And there's also, the whole book that Jung wrote called Answer to Job, which is Jung's attempt to understand, explain, and struggle with the dark side of God. And I'm sure if he was here, he'd say, it isn't that simple, that you can't, God just doesn't get nice that easy, But it's something that we all struggle with. So, yes.
Spirits, and they work with extraction of evil spirits. But usually in shamanism, the purpose of the human spirit is not just a figment in your imagination, but it's sort of a call into power, which might fit in the middle.
Yeah.
Your scene is really, truly dangerous, real things, and not figments, such as your imagination.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that personally, I don't know what to think about the notion of archetypal evil. I'm still struggling with it myself. Maybe someday I'll write a book or something. But I realize that people have been struggling with the issue of evil for, 10, 20,000 years at least, and haven't figured it out yet, so I guess it's okay to still struggle with it for a little while. Yes?
I think a good example of an archetypal evil thing is like Mother Nature, you think of it as...
Mother what?
Nature.
Mother Nature.
Being nurtured. But since the writing of the... I think Lester put out a book called Gaia, and it illustrates that if you don't pay attention to the rules of nature, that's true.
Yep, that's true. Yeah.
So that's the evil side of it.
Well... Or you have it's I don't know if I don't know. It means you gotta respect Mother Nature. You know? I don't know.
Well, Lester's point of view is that if you don't regard, if you don't know the rules.
If you don't know the rules, right.
You're gonna wipe, you know, she'll wipe you out.
Yeah. Yeah. She may do it even if you do know the rules. Well, it's almost 9:30. How about one more question? Anybody has one? Otherwise, we will call it a night. I want to thank you all very much for coming. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU and Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.